This episode is brought to you by Currys Business. Whether you run a bustling cafe, a busy office, or an inspiring classroom, Currys Business has the tech for your 2025 business plans. Upgrade with their January epic deals with up to 40% off hundreds of products. From laptops to TVs, connected mobile to coffee machines. Shop at business.currys.co.uk, visit your local hub, or call their UK-based specialist business centre. Currys Business, powering your business in 2025.
Adobe Express is the quick and easy create anything app. It's my go-to for making my business stand out. From videos and social posts to flyers and logos. Search for Adobe Express to find out more and use it for free.
From Entrepreneur Media, this is Problem Solvers, a show in which entrepreneurs do what entrepreneurs do best, solve unexpected problems in their business.
We were completely wrong.
And I'm just like, it's not selling.
It was like, we have to start from scratch.
I'm Jason Pfeiffer, the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine.
At age 24, Jonathan Goodman was a perfectly good personal trainer. But people treated him like he was an incredible personal trainer, like the authority on personal training. Other personal trainers looked up to him. And John admits, this was a little crazy.
There is no conceivable world where I knew more than people who had been in the industry for 10 or 20 or 30 years.
So why did they treat him like an authority? Well, John got to wondering about that.
What I realized is that the reason that I was so successful as a personal trainer had actually very little to do with my tangible skill set in personal training or fitness or physiology.
Instead, it had to do with something else that he did. He wrote a blog and he wrote a book. And even though he was young and certainly not the wisest person in his profession, his ability to communicate elevated him in his profession.
And so I started to realize and I started to see similarities amongst other industries where actually there's a rate of diminishing returns in industry-specific knowledge in just about every industry.
And that's because industry-specific knowledge only gets you so far. But when you combine that knowledge with other skills, like the ability to write or teach, your value grows exponentially. This eventually developed into a theory for John, a theory that he calls leapfrog skills. They are specific skills that help elevate you in any profession. And before I tell you what those skills are, let me step back for a little context. First, yes, I'm sure you're noticing I have a cold and I sound like hell. My apologies. I still have a podcast deadline to meet. But don't worry, because this episode will mostly be an interview that I did with John when my voice was normal. And so next, let's actually learn about John.
Hello, my name is Jonathan Goodman.
And Jonathan Goodman, who the hell are you?
I'm a father of two. Got two young boys. Third boy on the way. I started a blog as a personal trainer in 2011 when I self-published my first book. Grew into the biggest blog in the space, 4 to 6 million people a year. From that, self-published 11 books, 8 digital programs, hosted 5 conferences over the last 13 years. This will be my 13th straight winter living abroad as well. So I've traveled for 4 to 6 months out of the year for the last 12 years and counting now as well.
I love that your answer was a mix of personal and professional. Not everyone does that. I sort of was asking professional, but I see how connected they are for you.
Yeah. I mean, there's always a way to maximize different things, right? And I think what we do too often is we put too much emphasis in maximizing without really thinking about why we're maximizing that part of ourselves. I think that we all have kind of a triangle that guides our life, right? One is business, money. Another one is family, relationships, community. And then the third one is health and fitness. And I think that over the time, the process of getting better is actually the process of just thickening one arm at a time of that triangle, increasing the strength of the whole structure. And I don't think you can have one and really enjoy that one without the other two.
As you can tell, John is a really thoughtful guy. It's one of the reasons we've become good friends over the years. And I've been really excited about this new book that he has coming out. It's called The Obvious Choice. And really, it is a much needed guide to winning in business as a human in an all too online world. Or as John says it himself,
The Obvious Choice is a guide to winning in business without feeling like you have to win the internet.
John focuses on what actually advances your goals in meaningful ways and what does not. And this is also why he wrote about leapfrog skills in this new book of his. So here's what we're going to do today. John and I are going to unpack more of his idea about winning in business without winning the internet. And then we're going to get into leapfrog skills. And by the end, we will have separated what really matters from what really doesn't. All coming up after the break. All right, we're back talking with my friend, Jonathan Goodman, about his new book, The Obvious Choice. And we're going to pick up with this idea that he had about separating winning in business from winning the internet. So we'll jump into that. And then I promise this is the last time you will hear this terrible voice of mine.
The emphasis these days seems to be on trying to become an influencer or a creator or an entertainer. I consider those three terms to be synonyms of one another. And again, there's nothing wrong with them. But what you're doing is you're playing an entertainer's game. An entertainer's game has different time horizons, rules of engagement, odds of success, and reward mechanisms than a business person's game. Right? It used to be we'd perhaps go to Hollywood and know that we're going to wait tables on weekends and know that it's going to take a long time and know that the odds aren't good, but know that there's outsized rewards for a chosen few. And the people who made the pilgrimage to Hollywood, they knowingly signed up for those rules of engagement. Wonderful. Yeah. Hell
they
yeah.
At least, sure. They at least bought a lottery ticket. They understand it's a lottery ticket.
They understand, right? Yeah. Inspirational, incredible. The problem now is that I don't think that those rules have changed.
Mm.
I think, though, that a lot of us are playing that game unknowingly, but like, they don't desire those outcomes and they don't want those risks.
In other words, you're saying when you go to Hollywood, you buy this lottery ticket, you hope it's you.
Yeah.
You hope you become Tom Hanks. But you also know the chances of that are low.
Pretty low.
But the internet creates this perception that victory and money is everywhere and to be claimed by everyone.
Quickly.
And quickly. And it leads to this fractured experience where you see success all around you.
Yeah.
And you cannot figure out why you cannot access it. And you assume that because the success is all around you and therefore available to everyone, it seems like that you must just be doing something terribly, terribly wrong.
You see perceived success around you.
Very important.
Do you actually know whether these people are being successful? All of these folks that you see or you perceive or the story in your head that's being created, that these other people are getting all this attention, what is that translating to for them? Is it translating to actual tangible rewards that they desire? Now, that might not be financial rewards, right? Is that translating to actual rewards they desire? In some cases, yes. The next question that I'd ask is that translating into sustainable long-term success? Whatever that definition of success is. You see, when we compare ourselves to somebody, particularly people online who we don't know, which is often who we're comparing ourselves to, It's always somebody close to us. You know, neighbors compare themselves to neighbors, colleagues compare themselves to colleagues. Like somebody who's successful in a totally different field, I'm not jealous of them. I don't compare myself to them. Somebody who's successful in my field, I'm saying, oh, you know, I feel like that should be me. How can I make that me? But when we compare ourselves to people, we very rarely compare ourselves to one person over an extended period of time. Instead, what we do is we compare ourselves into what I call a representative conglomerate of people. So at any one point, you know, there's a section of the book that talks about broken clocks and how a broken clock is right twice a day, that Jay-Z line, right? Well, we compare ourselves to outliers. Outliers are people often who chase after trends or fads. And at any one point, if somebody chases after a fad, yo, somebody is going to hit it. At the right time, in the right place, and all the stars are going to align. And it's going to seem like at any given time, somebody is always hitting it at the same time and growing faster, way, 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 way faster than you. And that is 100% true. But what you're not seeing is that the person who jumps after these trends is very often the person who made a low quality decision with very bad odds of success. You know, if you make a decision to buy Dogecoin and mortgage your house, you might hit it at the right time.
Yeah.
You can't argue with anybody reasonable that that's a good decision. Let's say you have a 3% chance of success. Terrible odds. 97% chance of failure, but a 3% chance of success. Mm-hmm. And so at any one point, there's always going to be people who are making these decisions that have that low odds of success. Now, we don't compare ourselves to one person over the course of their careers. We compare ourselves to whoever is in the spotlight right now. And that inevitably changes. And what we do unconsciously is we compare ourselves to whoever's in the spotlight, creating the perception that there's always somebody winning faster than us. Whereas it's not one person, it's them. It's a group. And the person who buys Dogecoin and mortgages their house is also the person who's going to make, inevitably, a whole bunch of really low quality decisions. And the worst thing that can happen when you make a bad decision is it works.
Your insight that we are comparing ourselves to a conglomerate really snapped into focus at the end of that answer there, where I realized that the thing that we do, and I totally do this too, is that I compare myself to whoever happens to be extremely successful at the thing that I'm doing right now.
Right.
But I'm not tracking that one individual person. So if they if they burned out fast, and they often do, right?
Sure.
If it was a fast rise and a fast fall, and who knows why, but oftentimes, of course, the answer is just because they spent an insane amount of money on newsletter subscribers or on
whatever,
getting that attention, whatever it was, right? It's often not sustainable. And so I don't then learn the lesson of that didn't actually work out long term for that person. I just transfer their success over to the next person. And it always feels like there's this consistent layer of someone above me. That is a really, really wonderful observation.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of ways. I mean, this book is fantastic. And I'm excited about it both as a reader, but also as a friend of yours, because we've been talking about you writing this book for a long time.
So long. You've been the number one supporter. I mean, God,
I appreciate
the amount of emails I've sent you asking you for favors, and you said this to me.
Yeah.
When about endorsements, writing a book is the one time where you have to ask so many people you admire and that you're grateful for in your life for a favor without being able to really return that much, which is a very difficult thing to do. And you've been the greatest supporter, and I'm just so grateful for you. So thank you.
I appreciate that. You know, I'll say I want to get into one section of your book that I think just beautifully illustrates how to orient yourself towards success in a sustainable way, the opposite of what we were talking about a second ago. But before we do, let me just say to that point that you just made. So number one, I found from my own experience of launching a book that the experience of asking for favors scared the hell out of me because I was so uncomfortable asking for favors. But what I found was that almost everybody, not everybody, but most everybody who I reached out to were very glad to do it. And the reason they were very glad to do it was because in some way or another, I had done something for them in the past, and then I had never given them the opportunity to repay me. And they actually were pretty uncomfortable by that. You know, I spent all this time thinking about how asking for favors it puts people out. It is a burden upon people, which by the way, is literally my greatest fear. Like, my greatest fear is being a burden to people. That's what I operate every day trying not to be that. And so I thought asking for favors is a burden. What I realized is that not asking for favors was actually the burden because that meant that nobody could ever repay me. So now, you know, like you and I specifically, and you know, whoever, for anyone listening to this, like, who the hell cares about you and my, but like, you know, I'm not keeping any kind of tally, but when I think of you, I just think of you have offered a lot of advice in the past. You have gone out of your way for me in the past in ways that, like, I don't have like a ledger on, but it definitely makes me feel like yeah, of course I want to like step out and help. And also, life is long. You know, there is a, to do favors for people is to build a kind of ongoing social debt, which is actually very healthy. I owe you, you owe me. We go back and forth and back and forth. One other thing to add here, which is to build those kinds of relationships, which is like the kind I have with you, which is to say, you know, we're both sort of in similar fields. We trade a lot of notes. We are super brutally honest about like what works, what doesn't. Once you have those relationships, it starts to demystify some of the stuff that you were talking about before, about how you compare yourself to other people's success, because you start to learn what success looks like in public and what it feels like in private. I have so many friends of mine, and I'm sure you do too, who on paper or in public seem very, very successful, but they're incredibly burned out, but it's actually not making them nearly as much money as it looks, but they're actually miserable. And once you know that, you start to understand what quote unquote success actually is.
I have a friend like that. Yeah. And every once in a while, he'll ask me to borrow $5,000 or $7,000 to meet payroll.
Wow. Wow.
And he's always good for it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, but he's clearly living that tight.
Mm-hmm.
He's clearly living that tight. I think the only other thing that I'll add to that is, and I don't know whether other people feel this way. I guess I've been through books and textbooks and projects and the software platform I have and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I have such a tremendous amount of respect for people who do just real shit, like big stuff, mm-hmm. like who actually take the time and the effort and the care and the consideration to do something meaningful. Knowing that in the short term, there's going to be a pretty significant trade-off.
Mm-hmm.
And I get this feeling that there's this bubbling underneath the surface right now in our cultural zeitgeist whereby so much emphasis is on this short form, short term, superficial, here today, gone in 25 minutes on social media and the algorithm content. You know, what are we doing that somebody who actually takes a step back and says, yo, I'm going to take a year, or in this case with this book, I'm going to take 3 years and put my heart and soul into a project.
Mm-hmm.
I get the feeling that there's a certain kind of respect there. I feel it for others. You know, somebody comes to me and it's like, yo, you put your all into this thing, man.
Mm-hmm.
I want to support that. I don't know if that's just me. Might be. I'm not sure. But
no, it is, because I also know people who basically just bought their book. I feel less invested in supporting them because then I'm not supporting them. I'm supporting their investment.
I like that.
Yeah. But when somebody really puts themselves out and makes something, you want to support it. So let's talk about one really tactical, super interesting thing that, and cool. what I love about this kind of thing is what we're going to talk about here is a concept you have called leapfrog skills. Okay. And I'll have you explain that in a second, but I'll tell you that the reason I really gravitated towards it is because, number one, once I saw you articulate it, I saw a lot of what drove my own success in it. And then number two, I think some of the most powerful things that you can share with people are actually things that innately make sense, but that nobody had spent the time putting words and structure to, you know?
Yes. Yes. Makes you aware of a truth that you've always known.
Yeah, that's right.
That's what I love about great fiction, particularly,
mm.
is there'll just be this way of them telling a story and you're like, oh, that's how the world works. Right. I knew that, but I've never thought about it. What do you want to know? What do you want to know about leapfrog skills and leapfrog learning?
Okay, well, let's set up we're not being abstract for people. Set up what leapfrog skills is.
So this goes back. My career started as a personal trainer. Right? Mm-hmm. I was a personal trainer for a lot of years, self-published a book for personal trainers, started a blog for personal trainers, did that whole thing.
Yeah.
And what I realized is that the reason that I was so successful as a personal trainer had actually very little to do with my tangible skill set in personal training or fitness or physiology. I wrote a book for personal trainers when I was 24 years old. There is no conceivable world where I knew more than people who had been in the industry for 10 or 20 or 30 years.
Right.
And so I started to realize, and I started to see similarities amongst other industries where actually there's a rate of diminishing returns in industry-specific knowledge in just about every industry. And it's actually a relatively low point. Like in almost every industry, what you need to do in order to get your customer or your client or whatever your patient, whatever you call them, in order to get them results or build this widget that's going to achieve the thing is actually a reasonably low level of knowledge specific to your industry. And so I realized, I was like, okay, I've got a mediocre to low skill set in biomechanics and physiology and whatever. But the reason why I became successful as a personal trainer in Toronto originally was I also gained a mediocre to low quality skill set in behavioral psychology and in writing. And so what I realized is that 1 + 1 = 2, there's linear growth that actually starts to taper off over time if all you're doing is learning about your industry.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that you get exponential gains is you start to combine complementary knowledge bases.
Yeah.
And it seemed like there were certain skill sets that now I call leapfrog skills that seem to add this exponential element. And what's cool about them is you can actually add them into any industry knowledge and give you exponential gains of success in that industry, either as an employee or as an entrepreneur or business owner. But what they also are is these are skill sets. You know, we've got a lot of job displacement coming down the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a lot of people who are going to be kicked out of their industries because their industries aren't going to exist coming down the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
This is how you build resilience in an unfamiliar world, in a world that's ever changing, is you gain these complementary skills. So what are they?
Yeah.
So I identified a number of them, but business writing, you know, get to mm-hmm. the point, state it simply, have a call to action. And business writing is not like necessarily writing blog posts. Writing text messages, emails well, how do you communicate effectively through writing? A lot of our communication.
LinkedIn posts.
A lot of our communication is asynchronous now, isn't mm-hmm. it? So business writing, behavioral psychology. What are the main cognitive biases? Can you name the top five off the top of your head
mm-hmm.
so that you don't fall into them and so that you also can ethically persuade customers understanding them?
Yeah.
Presentation skills, I think, are very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the other ones? What did I
hear? Conversation,
finance, wealth management,
mm-hmm. and sales.
And sales.
Yeah.
And so at any one point, you can combine your industry specific knowledge with a low to mediocre level of ability with any of these things for exponential gains. And the coolest part about this is you actually don't need to be very good at any of these things. You need to gain an 80-20 because most of your industry is going to completely ignore them. Like I was a mediocre to just okay personal trainer who had a low level knowledge of behavioral psychology, who was just an okay writer. And I just left my industry in the dust.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can do this with just about anything. And so then we get into, okay, well, like, how do you gain this information? So I put together a framework called leapfrog learning because I'm sure I'm not alone in this, knowing the audience of this podcast, Jason.
Yeah.
The minute that I'm reading or studying something, I feel this unshakable guilt of what I'm not studying, of what I'm not getting better at.
Yeah.
And so I had to devise this system to make it okay to go in all in and focusing on acquiring a new skill or knowledge base, knowing that other stuff also was going to have its place, but this is a time for the one thing. I think the reason why adults very rarely evolve the way that they could once they become an adult is they never actually focus on one thing. They're diluting their efforts amongst too many things.
Yeah.
And so what I figured out, leapfrog learning basically,
you know what, actually, John, before you dive into leapfrog learning, let me also just point out that what I think is really useful about this framework, aside mm-hmm. from everything that you've just said, is that it's a really useful diagnosis of why you haven't reached that next level of whatever it is that you do. Because you can say, or now you can, if you take as fact what you have said here about leapfrog skills, that there's diminishing returns on your very specific knowledge base, but that if you combine it with these leapfrog skills, whether that's business writing, behavioral psychology, conversation, sales, and so on, that it will lead to exponential growth. If you just take that as fact for a second, then you say, oh, okay, wait a second. Well, I haven't done that. What I keep doing is I keep just drilling down into my specific core area. So what maybe I'm getting stuck because I haven't expanded beyond the thing that I spent so long believing I only needed to focus on. This is me. This is me. Yeah. So I did pretty good in media. I caught a couple lucky breaks. I rose the ranks, but also I was pretty fixed into the income that I get as someone in media, which, I will have, is relatively modest. And it wasn't until first I realized, okay, I need to do more than just be an expert at like writing and media. Mm-hmm. First I need to understand like the business of this, which I hadn't before. I need to step outside of the core skill that I have and understand business. And then once I started to understand business, I started to apply the skill that I had, which was writing, to the business. And then I had this combination that was unique in the marketplace.
Yeah.
Then I was able to walk into situations and because I do all this stuff outside of Entrepreneur too, where people would value me because I knew how to communicate about this stuff better than they did, even though they understood it way better than I do.
Yeah.
I do not have decades of experience in business building. I don't. What I do have is access to a lot of smart people who I could bend their ear like you, and then the ability to take that information and turn it into something that's really consumable. And that is a combination of skills that actually unlocked the exponential growth. So when I see what you're describing here, I see me. Like, had I stayed in my core skill set that I spent decades developing, I would have actually been pretty stuck. But it was my willingness to combine skills and figure out what the right mix of those were that actually unlocked it for me.
And so I question why we get stuck doing that. And I think it's easier.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Once we're good at something, it's easy and comfortable to just continue doing that, more of that same thing. We deceive ourselves into thinking that we're doing professional development by reading up more about our industry or about the newest research or whatever. Whereas the reality of what it is we're actually just patting ourselves on the back.
Mm.
For the most part, you're really just reading things that feel good because they reinforce what you already know, when there's an ease and a comfort in that. And I'm not saying don't continue to develop yourself within your own industry. Of course not. That's not at all what I'm saying. I think it's very important. And I give a percent breakdown even of what the amount of time based off of where you are in your career that you should probably spend on industry-specific knowledge.
Which I really like. By the way, because I have your book in front of you, I will just read that, which is you say year one, 75% industry skills, 25% leapfrog skills. Mm-hmm. Year two, 50-50. Year three and onward, 25% industry skills, 75% leapfrog skills.
Yeah. And you might be thinking that your industry is different. And it's possible that it is.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But not very much.
Right.
Not very much. And the reason that we dive in, I think, has to do a lot with comfort.
Mm.
It just feels good and it's easier to learn about things where we are already an expert. And we can go home at the end of the day and we can pat ourselves on the back and we can say, I did my self-development for today. And then we can look at other people and say, I'm better than them. Why are people paying more attention to them? That's not fair.
Yeah.
This is not how things should be. And perhaps it's not.
Mm-hmm.
But I've come to the conclusion that it's more important to understand the reality of how things actually are in the world and learn what those rules are, and then decide how we want to play the game ourselves.
Yeah.
We might decide that we still want to play our own game, understanding the trade-off that we are not going to make as much money or as big of an impact or move up in our industry as much as possible, which is perfectly reasonable. It could be quite noble, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
But it should be a very concerted decision.
Yeah. So let's talk about leapfrog learning. How do we develop these skills?
Leapfrog learning is quite simple. Well, I mean, if you understand and appreciate the fact that you really only need to gain a mediocre to low quality to low level skill set, it actually doesn't take very much time. What it does is it requires immersion. And so once you discover what skill you want to learn, there's two steps to it. Step one is you take 60 days and you immerse yourself completely in it. And step two is you teach it. And so I'll give you an example. I really wanted to know, this is a number of years back, I really wanted to know all about how artificial intelligence and automation was going to change and redefine and or displace job roles in the coaching industry, particularly the fitness coaching industry. And so what I did is I went and searched for, at that point, every single book that was written. So over the course of 60 days, I read 7 books. There's way more now. But I read 7 books on job displacement and job redefinition with automation and artificial intelligence. I listened to podcasts. I spoke to people who I know were interested in it. And for 60 days, I immersed myself in it. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of 60 days, I took all of the stuff that I'd accumulated and I wrote a really, really detailed document of all of my findings. Mm-hmm. And I shared it with 5 colleagues. I did the same thing with building a family's wealth management philosophy. You know, like how do you look at money as a family?
Yeah.
Right? It's not a maximization operation most of the time. How do you make reasonable, logical decisions towards money, especially with all the craziness out here with cryptocurrencies, with NVIDIA, with whatever, right?
Sure, sure.
How do you keep your head on straight when all this is going on and all these people are making so much money and they're not you? And oh shit, why didn't I buy Tesla stock? Mm-hmm. Whatever. And I did the same thing. I became fascinated in the psychology of money. So of course, Morgan Housel's book was in there. But I also became fascinated with what people who work in the money fields actually do with their own money. Because oftentimes that's very different. Over 70% of mortgage fund advisors do not invest in their own mortgage funds.
Oh,
or sorry, mutual
that?
Funds. Mutual funds.
Mutual funds.
Not mortgage funds. And the reason for that is not that the mutual funds are bad. It's that the mutual funds don't align with their goals. Generally, mutual fund advisors are younger men and women. The people who invest in mutual funds are older. Mm-hmm. It's just different games, of course, right? And so same type of thing was I immersed myself for 60 days, read as much as I could possibly find. I read, you know, that's how I do it. Some other people listen, some other people talk, read as much as I possibly could. Allison, my wife, and I had multiple discussions as I was reading. If I came across something I thought was interesting, she'd read it as well. We had multiple discussions. And over those 60 days, we put together our family's approach to wealth, our own philosophy. And then I recorded a presentation for the people in my mentorship, and I recorded a podcast episode that taught my 4-bucket approach to wealth.
Yeah. You know what I love?
And now I have that skill.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And it's not to say that I won't continue to develop that skill, but now I have that skill, then I'll move on to the next and the next and the next and the next.
What I was going to say was first, I love this very, very simple thing to do. Mm-hmm. It's easy, it's repeatable, barrier to entry is low.
Yeah.
Some people might think, well, okay, except that you have an audience and I have an audience. And that's why I want to draw people's attention back to that first example, where you wrote a report and you basically distributed it to 5 people.
So to 5 people.
Yeah. Everybody's got 5 people. And you know what? Frankly, it doesn't even matter if they read it or not, because it was the act of producing the document that mattered. I interviewed many years ago a woman who studies how people learn.
Hmm.
And she gave me this great phrase that I wish I could remember off the top of my head, but I can't. But what it was this scientific term for the right level of challenge that we must go through with new information in order to retain it.
Huh.
The idea is that you need to actively engage with new information. Mm-hmm. If that engagement is too easy, you forget it. You know, if you just if you just read something once and you don't think about it again, you've engaged simply with the information. By reading it, you're not going to remember it. If that information was, here's a sheet of paper that explains how to fix your car. Now go fix your car. That's too hard. You're not going to be able to fix your car.
Okay.
But there is a middle ground, an optimal amount of challenge that you must go through with the information.
Yeah.
And for me personally, that optimal amount is exactly what you've described. It is the act of repackaging and sharing that information with others. Yeah. Now, I just happen to be in the business of doing that. I interview people and then I turn it into a product of some kind, sure. Whether it's a newsletter or a podcast or an article. And that is the process by which I remember things.
Yeah.
But what you have said is so important, which is that you don't need that outlet. You can make a report for 5 people.
Yeah.
You can start an account on Medium and write for nobody. It's just the act of doing it that will force you to engage with the information in a complex enough way that you will remember it.
So near the end of the book, I give a 4-stage content creation progression.
Mm-hmm.
And stage number one, and I think actually the single best reason to create content is to learn. I think particularly early on in your career, but really all over the course of your career, you should look at content generation, whether that's writing, recording a podcast, whatever it is, primarily as a way to learn.
Mm.
As a way to learn. You don't care if anybody listens. Like, I have a podcast, same name as a book, The Obvious Choice. The primary goal of the podcast is to workshop material I'm considering including in my books. Having a podcast that we record with 2 co-hosts forces me to be there twice a week with material to present. It gives me immediate feedback. My two co-hosts, I'm a 39-year-old white Jewish guy from Toronto. My 2 co-hosts, 50-plus-year-old black guy, son of a preacher from North Carolina, and white daughter of a military family in the Bible Belt in South Carolina. That's on purpose. That's on purpose. Because they give perspectives into this material that I would never have myself.
Yeah.
The entire platform is designed for my work to get better as a result, for me to understand more widely as a result. The first blog that I ever wrote when I was a personal trainer was championlifestyle.blogspot.com. I wrote that blog for about 3 years. I did the whole, hey, I'm back. I know that I left for a while, but I mean it this time. I think I did that 4 times. I had one comment. It was from my mom on the first blog post. Nobody read it.
Yeah.
Nobody read it.
Didn't matter.
It made me such a better personal trainer. And then you know what? Stage 2. So you start creating content to learn. Stage 2 is you start creating content as a way to benefit your existing customers. You answer their questions. At this point, you don't know more than anybody else in your industry. You probably can't say anything that is eloquent or super in-depth, right? But you can add a lot of value to people who have a reason to listen to you. And that's actually, to me, the 80-20 of creating content. You get most of the benefits of content. You get the nurturance. You get the learning. You get the referrals, they'll pass it along to somebody else if it's been helpful, without the comparison.
Yeah.
Without falling prey to the insights, without the belief that you have to get onto this hamster wheel, creating and creating and creating stuff for free for these Silicon Valley profiteers. You don't have to do any of that. Most people in business should stay at stage 2 their entire careers. And then, you know, maybe that'll be discovered. Maybe that'll be picked up. The reason that we know each other, Jason, is because somebody named Adam Bornstein found my little blog that I wrote for my clients when I was a personal trainer in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, he was the head of media for Livestrong. And he
I didn't know that. I mean, knew that we connected through Adam, but I didn't know that that's how that happened. Wow.
That's how that all happened. And started publishing me Huey and the content for Schwarzenegger. He got me involved in a men's health book he was involved in. Mm-hmm. And so two things came of that. The first was, okay, cool. If you actually write stuff genuinely for one person who is your existing customer, probably you're going to create better stuff than if you're trying to impress the internet, and that will resonate more. The second is that what I learned over going viral many, many times as a small town personal trainer in Toronto, working at a small trainer gym, becoming one of Schwarzenegger's writers, becoming called one of the best trainers you've never heard of by Livestrong, getting in men's health books, is that it didn't generate me a single customer. Not one. Never did somebody ever come into the gym and say, yo, I heard you from that thing. I'd love to work with you. Not one. But you might decide that you want to progress into stage 3 and stage 4, which is where things like following count and thought leadership start to matter. And if you do, there's ways to approach that. But most people don't desire, I don't think, to be an influencer.
And you have just brought this conversation full circle in a really, really nice way, because what you just said there at the end was that those flashiest opportunities, the ones that lots of people probably saw, oh my God, he's been involved in this men's health book. Oh, he's writing with Schwarzenegger. Like, those are the things that people would say, oh, that guy is killing it.
He must be crushing it.
Crushing it. And as it turns out, fun as those things are, that wasn't the business. That stuff didn't even matter.
And I was crushing it. But it has nothing to do with that media stuff.
Right. Sure.
The social media, the success that I had there and the social media success that I have now is a lagging indicator of success in the real world. It is not a leading indicator. You don't do dope shit online in the hopes that it's going to enable you to achieve dope shit in the real world. You do dope shit in the real world, and then you amplify it by talking about it in a dope way online.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, really well said. John, two things. Number one, just for you and anyone else who possibly cares, while you were talking, I looked it up so that I had the right term.
Oh, what is it?
So it's called desirable difficulties. It's a term from education research. That comes from Polly Hoosman, who's an associate professor of anatomy, cell biology, and physiology for the Indiana University School of Medicine, who also does educational research, largely focused on factors outside the classroom that affect education. There you go.
I love gobbledygook alphabet soup behind people's names. It's my favorite thing.
Yeah, I know, right? So anyway, desirable difficulties is what that is. John Goodman, this has been an absolute pleasure, as it always is. Tell people how they can get in touch with you and get their hands on The Obvious Choice.
Sure. I mean, you can get your hands on The Obvious Choice wherever you get books. It's called The Obvious Choice. It's in Kindle, Audible, hardcover, all those good things. So please check out the book. I love it. And I'll tell you what, buy a copy. And if you don't absolutely love it, you can send me a message on either Instagram or Twitter. I'm at It's Coach Goodman, and say, yo, I didn't like your book, and I will send you back 100% of the money you spent on it. How's that?
Hell yeah. That's quite a deal. I don't think anyone's going to take it. We'll see.
Hope not. But if they do, I lose money, as you know, quite a bit. So, but I'll honor it.
John Goodman, thank you so much.
You got it. Thank you, Chase.
And that's our episode. I would love to hear what you think, and maybe even about a problem that you solved. You can find me at my website, jasonfeiffer.com. JasonFeiffer.com. Also, I have some more useful stuff for you. I write a newsletter about how to future-proof yourself and become more adaptable and optimistic. I would love for you to sign up. It is at jasonfeiffer.bulletin.com. Also, check out my other podcast. It's called Build for Tomorrow. In each episode, I take on some belief that we have that holds us back from progress and show you why it is not as bad as you think. Problem Solvers is a production of Entrepreneur Media and comes out every Monday morning, so make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss an episode. Thanks to Deepa Shah for production. My name is Jason Pfeiffer. See you next week.